Good morning. The Infrastructure and Tourism Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Will Kiva please call the roll?
Chair Andrade?
Here.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Here.
Ranking Member Silvers is excused. Representatives Antone, Burfield?
Present.
Brackett?
Present.
Daly?
Here.
Esposito?
Here.
G. Lombardo is excused. Harris? Lamarca?
Here.
Lopez is excused. Placencia?
Here.
Robinson?
Here.
Jaeger?
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'd like to remind everybody before we begin, please make sure all electronic devices are turned off or on vibrate. Good morning and happy Friday, everybody. I want to start off by offering a soft apology for having this meeting today on a Friday morning. But we have some important topics to discuss today. We'll be hearing initially two members' bills, and then going into some presentations by the Division of Emergency Management and the Department of Transportation. I know folks are eager to get home, so we will work to move through this meeting expeditiously, and I don't think we'll have any issues covering the topics. Seeing Representative Holcomb here, Representative Holcomb, you are recognized to present CS for HB 155.
Started his weekend early today. It's my honor to be here today to present to you House Bill 155. It is the repeal of TBARTA. That's the Tampa Bay Area Regional Transit Authority. It's made up of five counties: Hernando, Pasco, Pinellas County, Hillsborough County, and Polk County. It's a very simple bill, so hopefully I'll be able to aid in your expeditious meeting. It is repealing the TBARTA organization, and they have already voted to dissolve themselves. They did that on January 20th of this year. It also incorporates how the assets and liabilities will be handled, and it's my understanding that there'll be a small amount returned to each county based on their proportional share. I served on this board for about a year and a half as a county commissioner representing Hernando County, and I have nothing else on the bill, pending your questions.
Thank you, Representative Holcomb, for that almost succinct description of your bill. Members, are there any questions? Is there any public testimony? We have Chris Strandberg, representing Americans for Prosperity, waving in support. Is there any other public testimony? Seeing none, we are in debate. Members, any debate? Glad we all got the memo. Seeing no debate, Representative Holcomb, you are recognized to wave close on your bill.
Just wish everyone a great weekend and a good week off, and wave to close.
Thank you, sir. Kiva, please call the vote.
Chair Andrade?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers, Representatives Antone, Burfield?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Daly?
Yes.
Esposito?
Yes.
G. Lombardo? Harris? Lamarca?
Yes.
Lopez? Placencia?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Jaeger?
Yes.
All right. Report the bill favorably. Thank you, Representative Holcomb.
Thank you, Chair.
I do not see Representative Daniels in the audience, so I guess we will temporarily we'll wait for her bill. I won't say the word until she gets here, but I believe we have the FDOT presentation pulled up, so if you're ready, Secretary, I guess we can begin with the DOT presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, good morning. I thought I had a few more minutes, so I'm really honored to be here this morning to talk to you about both moving Florida forward and also our work program, how we build it, what all is in it, and the complexities of how we prioritize and program our projects. It's a complex topic. There's actually a lot of slides. Now I'm a little nervous because you said expeditious. But many of you have seen kind of the high-level overview, so we're going to go into more details today.
Secretary, that was just for the members. Please take your time.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So just to highlight real quick again what our mission is, this is something that we're very passionate about. It is to move people and goods and also contribute to economic growth and prosperity and preserve the quality of life and environment in Florida, because that is really, truly what makes us so special. And so this is a part of everything that we do. As we continue to look forward to the future, many of you may have seen this, but we're going to continue our central focus on communities as we continue to focus on safety, resiliency, technology, supply chain, and workforce development. These are all fundamental tenets of every infrastructure project and a big part of what we do day in and day out. To set up the challenge, first I'm going to talk to you about moving Florida forward. We have a tremendous challenge ahead of us. As you all know, we're growing at a rapid pace here in Florida with our population. We're over 22 million residents currently. We're projected to grow to nearly 25 million by 2030. So we have a tremendous challenge ahead of us. Recently, it was announced also that last calendar year, we had a record tourism number at over 137 million visitors. So as you can imagine, this places a tremendous demand on our transportation system. This slide here shows you that 60% of our population growth is concentrated in 10 counties. This is a data point that was developed basically from census to census over the last 12 years. What's interesting about this is many of the regions in our state have grown in excess of 30% in population during that time. And I'm going to talk in a few minutes about, you know, where that is and what that looks like. But this has placed a tremendous demand in our system and really feeds into what the governor's vision is for where we're headed in Florida and making sure that we continue to relieve congestion at a rate that will preserve Floridians' quality of life. So this is an interesting data point to look at. It shows you the population growth from 2010 to 2021 there on the left. And then on the right, it shows you what it's projected to be in the future. And you can actually kind of see the trends that the major intense population growth is actually occurring where there's room to grow. It also kind of feeds into the concept that where there's room for the population to grow, there's also room for transportation infrastructure to expand. And so this kind of shows you the general trend of where that population growth is occurring and how fastly it's occurring. So looking at the congestion, and so I just showed you growth. Now I want to talk a little bit about congestion. This is some data that we collect and monitor year in and year out, and you can see where the existing congestion is today and also how it's kind of projected to grow into the future. This is another important strategic data point for us as we continue to make investment decisions with our infrastructure. So with moving Florida forward, so this is the governor's vision to address congestion relief as we continue to grow. And you've seen this high-level overview. It's basically 20 projects. It's major infrastructure projects. Most of them would not have seen funding for another 15 to 20 years. And they're focused in those high-growth regions, high-growth areas in the state because, as I mentioned earlier, these are the areas where there's actually room for population to grow and room for transportation infrastructure to expand. Many of the projects on this list are facilities you're very familiar with, I-75 in Central Florida, which many of you probably drive on your way to and from Tallahassee. As you know, that there's a serious congestion issue there. I-4 in Central Florida. It's standstill traffic all day, every day. And again, that's one of the areas over the last two or three years, it's just grown so fast that the infrastructure is needed to keep up with it. And so, you know, something else that's important about this plan is that, you know, one of the things we deal with here in Florida is emergencies. Evacuations are very important. Many of these facilities are primary evacuation routes during emergencies, and so they're super important. Even when we're evacuating, the normal everyday congestion is a serious problem in getting people to safety before hurricanes. So this is an interesting way of looking at the Moving Florida Forward projects. These are the, as you see in black, the black lines there, these are the Moving Florida Forward projects overlaid on top of where the congestion is. So you can see how truly strategic these projects are. Now, you know, it's scheduled to be delivered over the next 4 years in its entirety. And so one of the key components of this is that those projects already had to be in our pipeline and ready to be advanced for construction. And so, you know, it speaks to our planning prioritization process, which Lisa's going to talk to you about a little bit later. But so these projects were basically ready to be advanced, and you can see how they're strategically located in those areas where that congestion is really significant. Wanted to take a minute because, you know, when you look at moving Florida forward, it's in a few very strategic locations, but we're also already investing significant resources into those other regions. And this is to highlight what we're doing in our existing work program in conjunction with moving Florida forward, which is going to be layered on top of that existing work program. And you can see that we have major complex projects in all of those regions of high congestion and high growth. This is to show you, this is not every project in our work program. We use kind of the $20 million or greater threshold because the map would get very congested with projects. And so this is to kind of focus more on what projects would be specifically related to relieving congestion. So you can see even in the Jacksonville area, Northeast Florida, obviously the growth is really high, congestion is high there, and we have nearly $2.5 billion already scheduled in our work program to be delivered over the next 5 years. So pretty incredible investments here, and you can see how truly strategic and visionary moving Florida forward is to tackle those areas that did not yet have those projects in the pipeline. So it's really, really strategic. So with moving Florida forward, I want to take a few minutes to talk about the plan in its entirety. It's really an interdependent plan. It's $4 billion of general revenue surplus injection into our program. And then we're going to use our traditional financing tools along with our legislative proposals to leverage another $3 billion. So the plan is $7 billion in its entirety. It's 20 projects. And it goes along with a pretty significant legislative package. And all of these things work together and are interdependent. So if any one small piece or part of it were to change, the whole plan would have to be rebuilt. So it's compartmentalized, it's its own plan, and it's intended to move forward in its entirety. Speaking just real quick to the legislative policy proposal side of this, we have a few very strategic areas that we're looking at. One is innovative contracting, where we're looking at introducing an innovative contracting type into our toolbox, which is called phase design build. We're really excited about that because it's going to give us a lot more flexibility to deliver projects faster, and also it deals with some other areas of design build. There's also revenue redirects proposed here. Vehicle title fees, rental surcharge, rental car surcharge, and dock stamps. These revenues were originally coming to the trust fund. They were directed away during the recession, and this proposal redirects those to our trust fund. And the estimate just for the next year is around $134 million. And as you can imagine, those revenues come to us directly, and then we're able to leverage a lot more out of that. So it's a really important part of this plan. There's a proposal in the right-of-way and bridge bond cap elimination. There's a monetary cap and also a percentage cap. We're proposing to maintain the percentage cap but remove the nominal monetary cap because our economy has grown so much and the cost of doing business has gone up tremendously. So there's bonding arterial funding. One of the things that's happened over the last many years is arterials have, this is your non-interstate roads, they are definitely behind in terms of keeping up with congestion and population growth. And so this creates some opportunities for us to use bonding to advance some of those arterials that are actually part of the Moving Florida Forward plan. And then there's some proposals in there for Garvey bonds, which is a federal financing tool that we have in our toolbox. So moving on to our work program, many of you may have seen this overview slide, but the governor did roll out his Framework for Freedom budget. There were a lot of record numbers in that budget. FDOT was no exception to that. We have, as proposed as part of that budget, is now the largest budget in our history at $14.7 billion. It is the largest by a magnitude of close to $2 billion. The current budget year that we're in was $12.6 billion. So it's just speaks to the the continued support and investments that are needed in our transportation system. And we certainly appreciate the support of you all in the legislature and the governor year in and year out in continuing those investments into our transportation infrastructure. This slide shows you a high-level kind of breakdown of some of those important components that we invest in. The numbers on this slide do not add up to the $14.7 billion. This is just breaking out those kind of, I would say, the strategic investments to show the diversity of our portfolio. With that, Mr. Chairman, Lisa Saliba, our Assistant Secretary for Finance and Admin, is here with me this morning, and she's our expert on all things finance. And so if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have her come up and go through some of the more detailed information about our work program.
Secretary, yes.
Mr. Chair, I don't mind offering, since this is a natural transition, would you like to switch and allow the representative to present?
That's actually very, very considerate of you, Ms. Saliba. Representative Daniels, you are recognized to present House Bill 145.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Democratic Ranking Member, and committee members. House Bill 145 names the bridge on Howard Drive in Jacksonville, Florida, on the north side, the Coach Gwendolyn Maxwell Bridge to Ribault. Gwendolyn Maxwell was the most decorated coach in girls track and field in the history of Florida. She recently passed away at 86 years old. She is survived by her daughter, Shakita. Miss Maxwell coached Jean Ribault High School track team for 20 years, leaving a legacy of female Olympic gold medalists, world-class athletes, Olympic board members, Hall of Famers, and all Americans, all known as Maxie's Girls. Gwendolyn Maxwell's teams won 269 track meets, 15 conference meets, 13 district meets, 12 regional championships, and 5 state titles. Coach Maxwell was named the Florida State Coach of the Year 5 times between 1976 and 1993. And she was also named the Florida representative for the National Track Coach of the Year in 1983, 86, and 1992. The year she was named Region 3 Coach of the Year for the Southeast United States. I am proud to have been an athlete under this great leader and to be a part of the legacy of Coach Gwendolyn Maxwell from Ribault Senior High. Because of her great leadership, I'm in the Hall of Fame in my high school, and I have a brick as an All-American athlete at the James D. Westcott Memorial Building at Florida State University. Gwen Maxwell was a mother, a teacher, a friend, and a part of the fabric of the Trojan family on Winton Drive. Today, I solicit your support of this well-deserved honor. Mr. Chair, that is the bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Daniels. Members, are there any questions? Representative Lamarck, are you recognized?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm definitely going to support this bill. I think it's warranted, and you gave a great background. Two questions. One, what was your best run, and what would you have done with NIL?
And what would I have done with what?
With NIL.
A lot. Well, first of all, I was a sprinter. I'm still a sprinter because I can't go long. I go short, hit it and quit it. But I ran the 100 and the 200 and 400 meters. I was the fastest female sprinter in the world in the military. And I was the fastest female sprinter in the nation in junior college. My fastest 100 meters was 11.3, where I qualified for Olympic trials.
Any follow-up? Any further questions? Seeing none, is there any public testimony? All right. Seeing no public testimony, members, we are in debate. No debate. Seeing none, Representative Daniels, you are recognized to close.
Wave close, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Kiva, please call the vote.
Chair Andrade?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cheney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Silvers? Representatives Antone? Burfield?
Yes.
Brackett?
Yes.
Daly?
Yes.
Esposito?
Yes.
G. Lombardo? Harris? Lamarca?
Yes.
Lopez? Placencia?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Yeager?
Yes.
And yeas, Mr. Chair.
So the bill reported favorably. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you very much.
We're back on the presentation on finance.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am excited to be here. I'll try not to be too excited for a Friday. It's not often that they let us finance people talk about and take you to a new dimension of understanding of the department's work program. I do hope that the presentation plants the seed of interest, knowledge, appreciation of the complexities of our program. And I hope that in some way you can see my appreciation and the department's appreciation for the great team back at the office that helps us bring this program together. So shout out to them. They watch from afar. They don't often come to the committee meeting. But this year's work program, this is a one-year budget picture of the five-year work program. And as you can see, our investments are mostly in the product and projects that make up the work program. And only 3% right now, or 2% as shown in this chart, is dedicated for debt service. Our operating budget is 7% of the total. So as you review the budget this year, what you see here is that Florida is contributing to the economy. As we've done our internal studies, we believe that Florida's work program investments return a 4-to-1 economic activity benefit to the state. So in this case, 1 year would translate into $53.6 billion of economic activity. We're proud as a state agency to know that we are helping to move the gross domestic product needle in Florida, and that when the economic activity slows, we are a tool in the toolbox to fuel the employment picture. So the work program, it's a general name. It is everything that we do. It embodies everything that we do. What you receive will be a list of project-specific projects and schedules and activities that we undertake by fiscal year. And the development process is transparent. We'll get into more of the planning process and why that's essential to the program. But it is important to note that this work program is supported by a balanced finance plan and cash forecast. We ensure that we do not have any lapses in our activity due to funding issues. We do leverage a cash commitment model, and this is probably will be one of the first meetings we have where we get into it. I will try to moderate my excitement and the time I take so that you don't feel like you're in a calculus class on Friday before spring break. But I can't help myself, so we'll keep going. From a big picture point of view, you can see that the transportation process can begin 20 years in advance of when we actually undertake a program. The transportation plan informs and establishes the goals for our investment. That becomes a five-year plan. Each year we translate those goals into actual project programs and investments to meet those goals. As you can see here, it's referred to as the Program and Resource Plan. The Program and Resource Plan then becomes our list of projects that we talked about previously. You have received not only the annual budget, and which you will consider in your deliberation as you review our budget, but also the five-year work program, which we delivered to the legislature and the governor on February 21st. Once that's approved, we do undertake a very specific statutory process referred to as adopting the work program, and then we begin implementation. And of course, we measure everything. What's important to note is that some of these processes are annual and some repeat over a five-year period. We do look at the five-year work program. We move forward for common years, and we build a new fifth year every cycle. So back to planning, big picture. We'll start at the top of that previous chart. Planning is in long-range, intermediate, and short-term planning cycles. In the long-range plan, the local entities get with their communities. They take input. They put together what is typically referred to as the long-range plan, or in this case, when they apply funding to it, which we assist them with, we actually provide financial forecasts to our local partners, and they develop the long-range transportation plan. What that says is that overall, generally, their priorities they identify the corridors they will focus on where they think the investments are needed over a 20 to 25-year horizon, which then goes into intermediate planning, where you may define projects that are needed to accomplish some of those longer-range goals. Short-range is when we get into the work program picture, which is the five-year planning horizon. And then what's important to note is that planning is a federal process. It's established both in federal law and state law. From a federal process, we do report what is referred to as, on this chart, the TIP-STIP. That is the Transportation Improvement Plan at the local level. Those plans are aggregated and become our state transportation improvement plan. Even though we have a federal planning process, that doesn't necessarily translate into that every project has federal funds on it. We also, you'll see in our presentation, our state investment in our transportation priorities, and then of course implementation of projects. So these are worth noting because the planning process is rigorous. And each increment provides opportunity for citizens' input, collaboration, and transparency into what is a very complex process. We'll get more into some of those issues as we move forward. I know the Secretary does focus his presentation on that collaboration and community input. It is iterative across the entire planning horizon, all the way back to, as we mentioned, the 25-year period, but then also in the five-year period. So metropolitan planning organizations, transportation planning organizations, local governments are charged with actually segmenting those projects that accomplish those goals and make them into project and priority recommendations to the department. We will integrate those into our plan, and then this is the step the department takes is to align those projects and priorities to eligible funds. And then we would program it into the work program, submit it to you, and then go into implementation. So major inputs include, of course, projects, as we just talked about, those segments. We need funding, and then we'll get into financing of the work program. Regarding the project input, again, we mentioned the long-range planning process. Sections here represent how we phase a project and the steps that we take toward implementation. Those can take, this entire life cycle can take up to 15 to 20 years. Now, it doesn't mean that we have to take each one of these phases sequentially. We are able oftentimes to run parallel processes and shorten that delivery horizon. But typically, if you run into any challenges or if something is particularly difficult to complete, it allows us to complete a phase or a segment without losing the concept of the entire project. You know, you can take it in bite size or we can do some parallel implementation depending upon that complexity. The one issue I will note is most often projects are delayed if funding is not available. Oftentimes needs exceed our ability to fund them, and therefore phasing it like this enables us, again, to try to, on a phased or sequential basis, make progress on a project and accomplish it over time, even if funds are limited and if projects. We have a lot of very important projects that might be competing for funding. All right, now it's important to note funding. State statute does prescribe the priorities by which we must invest our funding. You've probably seen this before. We are challenged with investing first in safety, the safety of the traveling public, and followed by preserving and maintaining the existing system. Our final investment strategy would be investment in capacity or enhancements to the program, which would be addressing congestion and those sorts of things. So building the program is complex. Some of what I talked about when we talk about projects and funding, each one of those have their own rubric and principles that guide them. And then we weave these things together into the list of projects that we submit for your approval. Now, I'm always challenged to show you what is the work program, what's it look like? Well, actually, it's a list of projects scheduled over time. Again, like I mentioned, we submitted that on February 21st for your consideration. Now, when you include the work program in your budget, you are actually including by reference approval of the five-year horizon. The first 3 years serve as our commitment to the locals that we will undertake these phases of the projects. And before it gets to you, it's also important to note it has the projects in the list have already been through a very rigorous public hearing process. We may have project-level public hearings. We have MPO-level public hearings where the actual list of projects that make up the new tentative go before the metropolitan planning organizations, transportation planning, or local governments, whatever the planning organization is at the local level. We are also on our horizon next will be a public hearing with the Florida Transportation Commission, who will validate the financial feasibility of the plan. And then ultimately, you are the approver, followed by the governor taking action to approve the budget. Now, this is where we haven't gone before. We are taking you into, we are venturing into new territory. But I am excited. This is the part that makes all of these rubrics come together. And so I always tell my team it's like a Rubik's Cube, but in this case, you can't peel the label off of one of those squares and move it to the other side. We gotta refix the entire rebuild, as the secretary said, everything is interrelated, and we have to rebuild if we can't get the right combination and achieve financial feasibility. So we take those prioritized projects and we model the planned commitments. So imagine the work program that's before you. We have over 10,000 project phases in a work program. We have a mix of funds that includes federal and state, and we typically assign a fund code for anything that requires specialized reporting, like at the federal level or the state level. So you're taking an exponential number of data points and modeling how those commitments will occur on the schedule. Then we take that data and we model the project payouts. So not only do we have thousands, tens of thousands of projects, we may have millions of payments because the payments may come in monthly, they could come in weekly. And we model that to determine how that is going to achieve financial feasibility. Next, we do the total estimated cash flow. Well, we also, I forgot to mention, one of the other inputs is the transportation revenue sources. And again, as I mentioned, those are state, federal tolls, maybe some other fees and things, financing that we leverage, and so on. So we take all of these rubrics and principles and we build this plan with all of these interrelated data points. There are millions of data points that we take together in order to determine a cash balance and a finance plan. Very similar processes, but we have an internal control system where we can test that financial feasibility from a couple points of view so that you're not getting something that can be manipulated in the sense that we're not, you know, you want the balance sheet to be true and validated. So we go through many processes. We undertake that until we achieve financial feasibility. Now, I can't resist. This is an example of our cash to commitment modeling in the cash forecasting terms. As you can see, we have to first protect our prior commitments. The blue stacked bar shows those contracts, projects that have already been committed. We have to plan and schedule payment. We're under contract, so we have a legal liability and a responsibility to make sure that we can pay those. We then begin to flow what would be the new budget year. And as you can see, the red line is a little bit smaller. As we get things started, the payouts may not be as fast. And then we begin modeling each year on top of that. So each successive year that comes in the work program would be dealt with in the same manner, so that we can show that even though we can commit $14 billion of projects and programs, we don't need $14 billion of income in any one year to make that happen. We actually leverage it. That is the precept of a cash commitment model. We also have specialized flows. If you're looking, I know I want to point out it's like the teacher. I want to point out what's really important here. We also have projects that are specialized flows. It could be a P3. It could be a mega project where we have agreement and milestone payments. So we also take those into account, not to mention debt service. And we do protect, this is how we ensure the protection of not only what we've undertaken, which is our prior commitments, but also that we're paying in a flow of funds so that we can cover our debt service, we can cover our annual budget, and we can cover what the new project commitments might result in the future. I will note that we also, what's interesting about our work program is we have all of these rubrics and principles, but then the statute says you must plan to deplete the resources. So we're not a bank. We don't hold the money. We spend the money. We invest the money. We're an investment firm. So what you're seeing here is that over time, our commitments are expected to reach over $14 billion. However, on an annual basis, our actual cash in our trust fund may range anywhere from $250 to $500 million. Sometimes, if you look at it on any one day, it's just like the stock market. If you pick a point in time, it might look different. It might be high or low. This is a representation of the averages. And as you can see, we work to keep a 2% cash balance to cover what might be what might unexpectedly happen. However, we don't keep cash in the bank. We're not a savings firm. We are that investment firm. All right, so I saved you. Now let's go back to the work program. Our funding that generally speaking, we receive about 75% state funds. We're fortunate as a state that legislators, the governors in the past have agreed to committed and dedicated transportation investments for resources for investment. As such, our federal funding allocation typically comes out to about 25%. That can change year to year depending upon schedules and projects. But in this case, Florida is able to have a very robust transportation system given the state investment. All right, high level, these are our standard work program five-year charts for you to more of a takeaway. As we approach Friday afternoon and you all want to travel, you can take this away and review it. We look at our investments a number of ways, one of which is by funding source. This is more detailed than talking about state and federal. This shows you that we have purely state funds. We also have bond funds. Our federal aid on this chart is a look forward. Again, points in time matter to us, and things may look different depending upon when you want to take a look at that data. Our future is looking like about 26% federal funds, and then the tolls and turnpike effort is on the higher average. In this cycle, it's at about 21%. Another way to look at our work program is by planned use. The portion on the left is our operations and maintenance. What this represents is that we're investing about 48% of our program in maintaining the existing system. And on the other side, capacity enhancements represent about 34% of our investments over this next five-year horizon. And then debt service is estimated to be about $1.5 billion or 3%. All right, so you guys made it through calculus. I'm happy to do differential equations with you if you'd like. However, Mr. Chair, we're open to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, are there any questions? Welcome, Representative Antone. We'll take you first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Thank you for your presentation in Gulf Lake. Quick question for you. In this five-year work plan, well, let me back up. At one point in time, there was a study on three new toll roads. Is that still part of some kind of consideration, or have they been totally dismissed at this point in time?
I'm Mr. Chair, I'm going to take an opportunity and delegate up.
Delegate up. It's a new term.
Wow. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you, Lisa, for delegating up. That's an interesting technique. I don't think I'm going to be using it anytime soon. I guess, Mr. Chairman, if I may answer that question, Representative, I'm assuming you're talking about the old MCORS effort. Okay. And so a few sessions ago, things were reconfigured, and we had Senate Bill 100, which directed revenues to arterial highways and also basically mandated the department begin a study for the Northern Turnpike extension, which we did that. We were required to submit a report to the legislature, and we did that. So we began that PD&E. We looked at alternative corridors for the Northern Turnpike extension, and we had some community engagement. We heard a lot of concerns. We had a lot of different groups, especially in that kind of Central Florida area, talk to us about the impacts of those alternative routes that were shown and the communities they would impact. We all acknowledge that there's definitely a need for Florida's future as long as we continue to grow. And even those communities in Central Florida have made it clear that transportation is their top priority. And so we're committed to listening to their concerns and working through a solution. And so the next steps for that are to, number one, focus our efforts on I-75, which is the really critical facility there. And that's one of the things we heard, which is also one of the projects that the governor has in his Moving Florida Forward proposal. But then at the same time, work with those communities to figure out exactly what that Northern Turnpike extension needs to look like.
Any follow-up? Representative Esposito, I saw your hand next.
Thank you, Chair. We've spoken a lot about resources and how we can, how we can build roads faster. So can you talk a little bit about, do you guys have the resources in order to implement the Moving Florida Forward plan?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative. So that is always, it's an ongoing concern for our economy as a whole. Workforce development has become a major priority for Governor DeSantis, but also, the legislature is very focused on it. Thank you for your question. And so in our industry, it is a primary focus because we have a record work program already, and we're continuing to try to find new ways to attract and retain talent into our industry, because in order to continue to deliver record budgets, we have to continue to bring more people to actually build those projects. And so it's a super important focus for us. With Moving Florida Forward, that takes another $7 billion and layers it on top of our work program. So yes, this is very important to us, not only for the industry as a whole, but also for FDOT and our employees, because we have state employees that are managing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of contracts. And so it's important that we remain good stewards of that money and manage them at a very high quality, high level. And so we need to attract and retain that talent. And we certainly do have a high vacancy rate right now, actually, and that's something we've been working on. We did receive recruitment and retention budget from the legislature last session, and that has already made a big dent in some of our needs. But we still have a significant need in the project delivery arena, which is those really qualified positions that are managing projects day in and day out.
Any follow-up? Representative Brackett, I believe, and then Representative Morgan.
Thank you for the presentation, Secretary. Question for you. You mentioned $14.7 billion into your budget right now that you're looking at for the year. And you also mentioned the $7 billion the governor put forward to fast-track some of these 20 projects, give or take. Is that $7 billion part of this 14.7, or is that phased in over the next number of years?
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative. So that $7 billion is intended to be delivered over a four-year time period. And that is really truly to manage the resources and make sure that our industry has time to plan and gear up to deliver those projects. As part of the proposal, $2.5 billion of that Moving Florida Forward is planned to be delivered in the new budget year. That is not part of the $14.7 billion. So once we'll do the $14.7 billion and the $2.5, it'll be closer probably to $18 billion.
Yeah. And if my memory is correct, $4 billion of that $7 was coming out of surplus?
Mr. Chairman. Yes, thank you, Representative. So the proposal is that $4 billion is from general revenue surplus, and then there's an additional $3 with our financing and leveraging.
And follow up? Representative Lamarca.
Thank you, Chair. Secretary, thanks for being here and for the presentation. The work plan, the increase in the budget, it looks like it's $2 billion over last year, roughly. Just want to confirm that's specifically work plan number.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, thank you, Representative. Yes, that's just kind of an estimate because that number, those numbers are going up and down. But the budget, the current year budget that we're in when it was proposed and adopted was $12.6 billion. And so the proposal in the governor's framework for freedom budget is $14.7 billion. And so that's roughly a $2 billion increase from this current year we're in.
I guess I was off by the point one, so that's $100 million. So $2.11 billion. So thank you for clarifying that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Members, any other questions? Representative Yeager.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Secretary, for your presentation today. Kind of outside the presentation, though, where does eVTOL and that technology playing a part with FDOT in the future? Right, you look at the 20-year plan and technologies like that. Right, they can ease, you know, congestion and things like that. You think of Tampa Airport, that I know has interest in it, and that could ease, you know, just the congestion along those veterans and 275 and such. So I was just curious where it's set with your department and in the future.
Mr. Chairman.
Secretary, you are recognized to answer that policy question in this Appropriations Committee.
Yeah. Representative, are you asking specifically about electric vehicle infrastructure or what? Could you restate?
Chairman.
You're recognized.
So the infrastructure to put that in place. But so the electric vertical takeoff vehicles, oh, right, that can move people. I know the technology is out there that's being used in Florida. But I was honest about the infrastructure and how FDOT would play that infrastructure.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative. So you're talking about flying cars, then? I'm assuming. Yeah. So actually, there is a lot of movement in the policy arena with the air mobility for, you know, individuals, and we call it advanced air mobility. We actually have a statewide team with the industry that's kind of working through these policy discussions and what that infrastructure would need to look like. It's an emerging technology, and a lot of industry professionals are looking at how they could do it, what it would take, and so, you know, we're obviously going to be a strategic partner and a strategic leader in that arena, and really it's going to be, you know, it is a policy level discussion, like what is needed in Florida so that this emerging technology can eventually be implemented.
Follow up. Representative Burfield, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, the question I have is in reference to the congestion areas and the geographical areas that we're looking at with these projects. So if I were to go back 10 to 15 years, they'd be very similar areas. So my question is, as you look at your methodology in configuring how you are going to approach those areas, are we approaching them differently today to ensure that in 15, 20 years, we're not looking at the same areas? Or have we changed the methodology to make sure that will happen, or do we need to?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you, Representative. That's actually a very good question. And it's a continuously evolving picture that we, and you saw the complexity of the process that we go through for planning and prioritization. Your MPOs at the local level actually develop a long-range plan. It's a 25-year horizon, and they update that every few years, and they build models based on this projected growth. And so a lot of what goes into that in terms of population is the census data from census to census. One of the things we've been experiencing in Florida the last few years is that several regions have grown much faster than what anybody would have ever forecast. And really and truly, you know, Lisa mentioned that it's a 15 to 20 year process from conception delivery for a project. That is because it's not because of the regulations. It's not because of all of the things we have to do to deliver a project. It really is truly because resources are finite. There's never enough to do everything that's needed. And so once you allocate those resources out, you know, it makes those timelines spread out much farther. And as you could see with the map I showed you, some of those high growth congestion areas, we already have major infrastructure projects funded there. And what ends up happening is you take the resources that are available and you move these strategic projects forward, but then there's still a lot more that needs to be done. That's what Moving Florida Forward is doing. It's attacking those areas that have seen this rapid growth over the last few years, and it's going to set us up for many years to come. But at the same time, that picture continues to evolve. And 3-4 years down the road, it could look different. And so we're continuously updating and monitoring that.
Representative Brackett, do you have another question?
Yes, one more question, Secretary. Thank you, sir. I know there's a $2 billion increase in the budget, just for my benefit, since I'm the new guy on the block here. Have you, on last year's budget, have you expended all that or encumbered all that money that you had last year? Is there any surplus in that budget left over, or can you explain that to me?
Mr. Chairman?
Recognize.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. So we're in that current budget year as we speak, and so we're continuing to deliver the projects that were committed, and we'll do that. And the plan is we monitor that. We're also measured on that by the Transportation Commission. And so the plan is by the end of the fiscal year that we will have all those projects let to construction and all that money will have been encumbered in terms of the work program. And now then we have our operating budget that we're measuring in the debt service and all those other components.
Representative Manto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. You mentioned the issue of attracting and retaining talent managing projects. What's the underlying issue there?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative. So we're still learning and researching what the underlying issue is. We do know that over the last several years, there's been a really intense focus on higher education. But, you know, even in our industry, we have tremendous career opportunities for people regardless of your education level. You can even leave high school and enter our industry and have a career path that makes you very successful. And so we're beginning to look at maybe workforce development in terms of the holistic approach to show you that, you know, you come to this industry, you actually can have a successful career path, whether you're in high school, vocational school, community college. And so that's really become a focus of ours, and we're going to continue to look at that. But, you know, the other challenge is that unemployment is really low in the state of Florida. And so the demand for people, like we need more people to do these jobs, unemployment's really low. And so where are those people going to come from? And that's a challenge that we're always facing as well, is finding those people to do those jobs.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to switch subjects. You know, like Nona is talking about some air taxi stuff. Who has the ultimate authority for overseeing projects like that? How do you plan for something like that?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative. So it starts with listening and having conversations with the industry, because as a state agency, we need to understand where that emerging technology is going, how rapidly it's developing, and really what kind of the market is saying about how those vehicles will be used. But then at the same time, there's going to be a very significant policy level discussion with you all in the legislature about what's needed, you know, in terms of regulatory processes, you know, because you got to consider safety and mobility and how it fits into communities and all that. So it's a really big conversation. We've started by, as I mentioned earlier, we've started by having kind of a statewide team with the industry to discuss what are some of those challenges, what are some of those hurdles, and how are they developing the technology and how do they plan to use it so that we can begin to align all those pieces and parts.
One follow-up. Last question, thank you. So going to a third subject, you know, we recently had a sales tax referendum in Orange County to possibly build commuter rail and things of that nature. And I heard there was some discussion that you could not build tracks in the median or the right-of-way adjacent to the beltway around Orange County. Is that something that you all oversee, or who decides that? Or is that some contractual language with the bonding authorities? That makes sense, what I'm asking?
It does, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, thank you, Representative. So so you're speaking to Central Florida specifically. There are DOT roads, there are local roads, and there are also tolling authority roads, CFX. And so it would be specific to whichever road it is and who has jurisdictional authority over that road. And I'll give you an example. For instance, with I-4, you know, as part of our planning, development, environmental study, and the design, you know, we actually committed to reserve room in the right-of-way with future construction for a rail corridor. And so it really falls to the agency that has jurisdictional authority and also, you know, the planning process. And so it could be any number of, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Secretary. I did have one question. I think there's at least four or five folks on this committee who served on an MPO or TPO prior to coming and serving in the legislature. And members, I'll just take a moment to let you all know that special project appropriations requests in this silo alone have come in at over $1 billion more in requests than last year, totaling over $2 billion. So there are a lot of legislators who believe that there are some road projects or priorities that should probably be fast-tracked within that TPO or MPO ranking system back home. Is the proposal of 20 projects outside of that work program model an indication that we should look at reviewing our work program formulation in the future, an indication that there's something that we're missing in how these projects get prioritized by MPOs and TPOs before they come before the legislature to fund the work program?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a big question. I would say typically, as a standard throughout the state of Florida, the planning and prioritization process at the MPO level works very well. It generally means that we have the right projects in the pipeline. We would not be able to deliver Moving Florida Forward if those projects had not already been planned and prioritized at the local level and were already in our pipeline in one of the various phases that Lisa highlighted. You know, one of the great opportunities we have with that process is because we phase our projects and they're in the pipeline. So now if we need to advance, you know, in a situation like we're in Florida with this high growth, we have projects that are in the pipeline that are actually advanceable to construction. If nothing had been done on those facilities yet in terms of developing that project, we wouldn't be able to deliver them that quickly. And so I would say for the most part, it works. It works well. You can point to any congestion issue in the state, and I can probably show you a project that's somewhere in the pipeline. And the real challenge is it goes slow because there's not enough resources to do everything that's needed. Now, there probably are some exceptions in some regions, and I would definitely encourage you to stay engaged in what your local MPOs are doing you know, just to, you know, to make sure that, that you're seeing things happening the right way, because there probably are some areas where maybe there's some other things that could be done. But in general, I would say the assessment is it works very well.
Thank you very much. Members, are there any further questions? All right. Well, thank you very much, Secretary and Ms. Oliva. I appreciate y'all's time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's amazing that Lisa did not have to answer one question, huh?
It's not over. Don't go anywhere. Next up, we'll have a presentation from the Florida Department of Emergency Management and Director Guthrie. Is it Director Guthrie or Secretary? I feel like I always mess it up.
Director.
All right. I got it right. Director Guthrie, you are recognized whenever your presentation's pulled up and you're ready.
All right, good morning, and thank you for having me here today, Chair, Vice Chair, and representatives of the Infrastructure and Tourism Committee. I'm here today to provide you with an overview on the FY22-23 second quarter disaster report for all open federally declared disasters. The General Appropriations Act for fiscal year 22-23 included proviso language that directed the division to provide quarterly status reports on the outstanding obligations for each open federally declared disaster. These quarterly reports provide an allocation of funding by appropriation category for the cash and budget authority needed to meet these obligations for the appropriate fiscal year. When the division prepares these quarterly reports, we take several factors into account, including historical data trends from previous storms, the public assistance timeline, as well as the type of cost share involved. When examining historical data trends, the division references recent storms that have impacted our state. Right now, those storms include Hurricane Michael and Hurricane Irma. We also reference where we are in the public assistance timeline. Many of you have heard me discuss public assistance before, but to summarize, public assistance provides federal disaster grant assistance and state match for cities, counties, and state agencies. Grant assistance may also be provided for the repair, replacement, or restoration of disaster-damaged publicly owned facilities and certain private nonprofit organizations. Currently, the division is extremely early in the public assistance part of recovery for Hurricane Ian. As of today, we have 921 public assistance applicants and are estimating that we will have over 9,000 projects. To compare this with historical trends, Hurricane Michael had 314 public assistance applicants with 2,332 projects, and Hurricane Irma had 1,224 applicants with 8,600 projects. Now you may say, why is it that we have 9,000 projects with 300 fewer applicants? I'm glad you asked that question. The reason for that is in Hurricane Irma, that was more of a coastal impact storm that rode up the coast. This penetrated deep into and crossed over the entire peninsula in heavy populated areas. So we're estimating that each one of those applicants will have more projects that they will submit than we had in Hurricane Irma. The division also references the type of cost share approved for the disaster. This can include a 75-25 cost share, 75% federal, 25% state and local, or a 90-10 cost share. In order to request a 90-10 cost share for Hurricane Ian, we must meet a threshold with FEMA. That number is $3,489,184. Currently, we are at $2.12 billion, about 60% of the way there. We need approximately $1.37 billion more. To put this in perspective, we are currently to put this in perspective, with Hurricane Michael that occurred coming up on 5 years ago, we are 95% of the way to a 90-10 cost share 5 years later. Now, I anticipate that we're going to hit this 90-10 threshold for Ian much faster. Why, you ask? Because, again, much more populated areas, much more damage, which will help us to get to that number much more quickly. So now I'm going to reference the tables on the right. The top table on the right is the second quarter report. Again, that would be from October to December. The top table on the right uses a 75-25 cost share as we are in the first 3 years, or I'm sorry, 3 months of that disaster. With $4.6 billion on a 75-25 cost share, that would be $754 million for the state, for a total of $5.35 billion. Now, as I move to the second slide, I'm sorry, not the second slide, but the second table, I want to call out the parenthetical there at the bottom. It's in very, very fine print. We have given you the most up-to-date information we have. We haven't given you just the second quarter report. We went and gave you the additional 45 days all the way up to February 17th. So that's why that bottom number is going to be $1 billion more. So as of February 17th, 2023, the federal cost share, $5.9 billion, state cost share, $472 million, for a total of $6.37 billion. Using the 90-10 cost share and making an assumption that we will hit that in this next year's budget that we're allocating for right now, then we were able to reduce what we're asking for by $300 million. Based on the historic trends, we are in our current status and public assistance timeline, we are confident that we will achieve a 90-10 cost share in the 23-24 fiscal year. But it may not come until late quarter three or quarter four before that happens. That's very, very, it's somewhat problematic. But again, we're only going to be asking for the 300, the lower number. The reason I say it may be problematic is we have to pay out, if we get an obligation today, it's got to be at the 75-25 mark. Therefore, I'm paying out 12.5% out of the state's cost share, taking 12.5% out of the $350 million in the special session to make that city or county whole at the 100%. When we get to 90-10, the federal government will allocate that very, very quickly to us. We will pass it through very quickly. But what it really means is I've got to take 7.5% back from that local community. That does not happen overnight. Local communities are very slow to give me that 7.5% back, even though I'm giving them more, if that makes sense to you. But I do have to offset that. So it's not as quick as journal transferring from one budget to another budget. It is. It usually takes us months to get that money back from cities and counties. So there is a risk, but again, it's a risk that we're willing to take by going to the lower number of $300 million. I'm sorry, of $472 million. So, sir, just three slides. Try to make it quick for you by explaining that. This concludes our presentation, and I will be happy to take questions. If you do have any further needs from us, you can always contact our Legislative Affairs Director, Kendall Kelly, and her email and number are there, sir.
Thank you very much, Director. Members, are there any questions? Representative Antone, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned on your slide 921 applicants. How do you define an applicant? What exactly is an example of an applicant?
Chairman.
You're recognized.
So an applicant is an individual that meets the criteria of being eligible for federal funding. These are historically, these are your city, county, quasi-government, so your constitutional officers, your independent fire districts, and in some cases, even CDDs, community development districts, qualify to be an applicant. In and don't quote me on this, but somewhere 2017-18, the federal government started recognizing nonprofits and houses of worship as eligible applicants. Probably one third of that number is nonprofits and houses of worship. That's what we typically saw in Hurricane Irma. So those are all eligible applicants. But for point of clarification, in case somebody asked me this question, the 12.5% match only for the state government only applies to those judicial, those quasi judicial government organizations. So cities, counties, special fire districts, constitutional officers. It does not apply to CDDs, 501c3s, C6s, and so on.
Director, regardless of who's in the White House, it sounds as if you have a little bit more faith in the federal government day in and day out than I do. I was wondering, you mentioned the dollar threshold. Are there any auditing requirements? Does FEMA just take your word for it in that dollar commitment threshold before you hit that 90-10? I guess, can you give more specifics on what it takes to actually qualify for that 90-10 split?
Thank you, Chairman, for the question. So, yes, there is an auditing requirement. The federal government, FEMA, will allocate that. They will do a 20% audit on our numbers, and only a 20% audit. And if that comes within their plus-minus ratios or their algorithm, they will go ahead and obligate what we've asked for. It is the state's job, more specifically, the Florida Division of Emergency Management's job, to audit every single penny at 100% verification. That is our job. So that's why we have such a big recovery unit that has hundreds of contractors that help us do that. So to answer your question very simply is, we make the request, they will audit about 20%, make sure it's within their norms, and if it is within their norms, then the rest of it, they will go ahead and to your point, they will trust us, and then we're required to vet and verify. I will say this, just as a piggyback to that, that number for us, as I mentioned, is around $3.4 billion. This is estimated to be an $8 billion disaster. So I'm extremely confident we will get to 90-10.
Thank you. To that point, though, I'm sure that amount's going to get reached. Whether or not it gets met and reached in this fiscal year is more the concern in crafting this budget. What assurances do you have that it will be met in this budget? And if it's not, is there a risk to the state if $300 million is not allocated, in this year's budget to meet the demand at a 75-25 split?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. I will say first to that, you all invested in us last year for some technology process improvements and streamlining. That has already got us to a point of somewhere between 60% and 65%. As a side note, we would need that IT sustainment to continue to do that streamlined processes and automation. That will certainly help us get there. With that being said, with the automation, the personnel, yes, I'm confident that we will get to 90-10 in quarter three or quarter four based on our projections. We have our foot on the gas. There is a very specific date that we are looking for, and that's 365 days from the date of disaster. So September 23rd of 2023 is a very significant date for us. We want everything we can obligated by that date. Based on our projections right now, we've already secured $910 million of mitigation funding. That's that number. It's 20% of the obligated number. We are projected to get to 90-10 even based on FEMA's projections. They're estimating we're going to get there by September 23rd. Not so confident in that number because, again, and I said this in prepping for this particular meeting, I have 921 today, as of today, I have 921 variables. If we have a big city, let's say, Fort Myers, Cape Coral, City of Orlando, that files some big projects for us, it's going to tick there very quickly. If I'm dependent on Hardy County, Arcadia, DeSoto, those are going to be $1 million projects, $2 million projects, $3 million projects. It's going to take a little bit longer. State agencies, we have some state agencies that have not filed their paperwork yet, and they have some $400, $500, $600 million projects. So again, it's going to be all about the timing. But again, I'm confident if we can get those state agency projects and those big city, big county projects that have heavy populations, we're going to get there.
Members, are there any questions? If not, the only other question I had is, what was the amount in the state cost share in the governor's proposed budget that we've been reviewing?
We have that number. I'm going to have to phone a friend on that one to my chief of staff and legislative affairs director. I'm looking to see if it's in my backup documentation, sir, so give me just 1 second. Chairman, I don't have that number in front of me, but we will get that back to you today or to staff, whichever you prefer.
Would it be reasonable to assume it might be about $220 million?
Okay.
Approximately.
If that's what you say, sir, I'll probably go with that.
I'm just trying to clarify for the committee that the governor's proposed budget, record high budget, highest we've ever seen, was missing approximately $500 million dollars in it in a very critical category. And missing at least $200 million if we're assuming all obligations are met. I just want to make that clear for everybody that these are big numbers we're talking about in an important silo, a critical piece of our recovery effort after Ian.
Any questions?
Ian, thank you very much, Director.
Thank you.
All right, members. Seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Brackett moves that we adjourn, and I hope you guys all travel safe and have a good weekend.